The following class was led by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 19, 2000. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
I was just thinking tonight that I was actually thinking about your question, Mary, last week, how this is different from pop psychology, and I was thinking if this is a shock for anybody here, I'm sorry. usually, maybe we go into, we're talking about egolessness, so we're talking about the mind, and very often, well, of course, we're all very interested in that, and we're interested in the self. It's all of great interest to us. And there are many courses and things that we can do and study that would help us along these lines, maybe kind of beef up our egos in some way. And this is about forgetting the ego, letting all of that drop away. But I should point out that this is not about putting down the ego or putting yourself down in some way or marginalizing yourself or your self-interests or whatever. It is just simply to not dabble in that. If we get into some kind of self-help kind of mode where we're trying to improve ourselves in some way, we, in effect, strengthen our sense of self, which in turn also strengthens our sense of separation, which in turn strengthens our sense of dissatisfaction and wanting something else and trying to improve and all the rest of it. And we don't realize that we slip off into this very unsatisfying way of life and trying to deal with our problems. It's a very subtle thing. And so if we really want to take care of the self, it's best just to forget about that issue. Besides, what is it you're going to do? What have you done that has ever brought you to any kind of ultimate satisfaction? We never find any such thing. And whatever we look for there always leaves us a little wanting, I think, in the end. So this is something that's radically different from any other way. And it is truly unique. There's no other way to approach this problem than by learning to recognize this kind of entanglement that we slip into so easily, and without really realizing, if it's never been drawn to your attention, just what is going on there when we get into these kinds of entanglements. There's your dissatisfaction, and there's nothing within that tangle that you're going to find that will ever do it for you, because it's part of this entanglement, and it involves misery and dissatisfaction and always reaching for something else. How do we find our way out of this? It is just simply to recognize what is going on here and to not get caught, and then maybe gradually to develop ways of thinking, ways of behaving, ways of taking care of your life that don't bring you into this kind of confusion and entanglement. And that's basically what we're dealing with here. So if there's any misunderstanding that this is about marginalizing the self or minimizing the self or something like that, no, it's basically about forgetting all of that. Just set that aside. Don't worry about it. And whatever it is that you expect you would get from that, that kind of involvement, you will not get. Whatever it is that you are hoping you would get, whatever that might be, some kind of peace of mind, satisfaction, some sanity, understanding of human life and the human situation, you will find it in this very way that Katagiri Roshi speaks of here. I'll probably get back to, there's just a mention of pop psychology I noticed in the reading for tonight, so I might have a few more words about that. I don't know. We'll see. I was just coming up to this little section, using the selfish self, on page 71, and here Katagiri Roshi said, Zazen, sitting meditation, is good practice for us. We can call it perfume because it scents our life. Of course, whatever we do scents our life, I suppose. He points out here how a fellow in the army, he kind of starts to smell like the army, I guess. It also, and of course, whatever else you do, you begin to take on a kind of aroma or fragrance or whatever of whatever it is that you're dealing with. Same thing here with his being a monk, in particular a monk from Japan. He says, even when I wear Western clothes, people still smell the monk on me. So, and he says, I cannot escape. So this is true. This is true for all of us. We all take on these wonderful fragrances and smells. I remember one time Katagiri Roshi was talking about that. Not one time, actually. He referred to this several times. I think he might have actually had this this wish. He said that he wished he could wear the cowboy hat, you know, the great big, you know, just picture this little Japanese guy, you know. He wants to wear this big Stetson, you know, and smoke the big cigar. And he would always stick the into everything. When he didn't need it, he'd put it in. If he needed it, he'd leave it off, you know. But, yeah, and wear the cowboy boots, you know. So just picture this, you know. So it was pretty funny. But, yeah, he would talk like that once in a while. He'd like to do that. When I was with him in Japan for a stretch, and I realized there when we were traveling about, and he did a lot of translating for me, and we would be visiting with different people, teachers and whatnot, and I really got the sense there that he had been in America for so long by that time that while he was still, to me, at least up to that point, seemed pretty Japanese to me. Had a very thick accent, his English, that's why I had to edit this, it needed some work, but his English wasn't really the best, and so he seemed very Japanese to me. Yet when we were in Japan, it was clear to me that he had been in America for so long that he had drifted from that culture that he was born in. And it struck me at one point where he seemed like maybe he was a man almost, you know, free of a home or free of any cultural ties. And in some ways, that might have seemed rather lonely. I think it was rather difficult for him to be in this country. But then when I saw, going back to Japan, that he was no longer, really up with the times in Japan, slightly out of step with what was happening there. It was very touching for me to see that. But nevertheless, he had this this fragrance he couldn't escape. I remember too. He said here, the next paragraph, when he said, "We often don't like the smells that perfume the air around us, so we resist them." And I was thinking too of a story here in Minneapolis. I think it was at the Uptown Art Fair, and Katagiri Roshi was there with some students, and some of the people he was with was a professor at McAllister, or professor's wife at McAllister, and some other people very high standing in our community, and that he had kind of wandered off a little bit to another booth, and he was looking at some stuff, but here he was dressed in his Western clothes, I suppose. I think he probably had a t-shirt on or a sweatshirt or something, and oftentimes he would wear a kind of a sailor's cap pulled down around his ears. But then a police officer came up to him and told him to move along. He was standing here, you know. And so whatever fragrance he was giving off at that point, apparently, the fine, upstanding people in our community who were with him, they were very incensed at this police officer commanding him to move along. But I think Katagiri Roshi understood the situation. I don't think he took so much offense. But it was it did kind of illustrate something that he's trying to point out here, I think. He's not talking about that. In fact, I never heard him talk about the story. I got the story from some of the people who were with him. Here he says that we often don't like the smells that perfume the air around us, so we resist them. And do you ever notice this? And not just the smells of other people, but perhaps the situations that we're in. He says we want to be free. He said, but the kind of freedom that includes such resistance is questionable. Because you say we want to be free, but we don't understand what's binding us. And what is binding us is right there within our own mind. But we're not paying any attention to this. We're always paying attention to that. That thing that's bugging me out there. That person, that situation, that smell, that aroma, I don't like it. And I want you to get it out of here, or I'm going to take it away myself, or whatever. We're always looking like this, but we miss what is actually giving us the trouble. And it is within our own mind. He said that we want to be free, but the kind of freedom that includes this resistance, he always called it resistance. He said that the freedom that includes this kind of resistance is questionable. We ought to question that. Question, what is it that you're seeking here? What kind of freedom are you looking for? Notice what is going on within your own mind. True freedom is not found in the air that surrounds you. You find it by noticing how you resist the perfumes of others or the perfumes of certain situations. A little further down, he says, we sometimes have the idea that that if we don't think of ourselves first, we'll fall behind. But the more we try to get ahead, the more exhausted we become. We don't notice, once again, we're always looking at the other. We don't notice that this has nothing to do with where we are and what is going on with us. Always comparing ourselves to others. And they're getting ahead of me now. And as if somehow this was some actual measurement of where you are. Where you are is taking place within your own mind. Why don't we pay attention to that? This is where we will find the kind of freedom that we seek. A little further down, he says, but even if we learn to use our life for all sentient beings, even if we fall into this more generous mode of mind, we may still have a sense of selfishness. I am using my selfishness for everyone. He says, I am saving all sentient beings. He said, there's no reason to think I am doing this for others. No reason to think. If you are truly acting for other, you don't need to think about that. You don't need to see yourself in the situation, and, oh, look at what I'm doing, I am helping others, etc. Just get yourself out of the picture. Get them out of the picture. Just act in a way that needs to be acted upon. And let that be your focus. Once again, this is where we find the freedom. We bind ourselves when we have to think of ourselves, what I am doing for others, etc. He said, you have to understand that through and through how strongly you love your little self. To do this, however, the self you must realize is not this small self. It is your true self, which is actually the same as the true self of others. What you really are is something inseparable from others. This is what the awakened realize. This is what they understand. This is how their view differs from our ordinary view. They do not see themselves as something separate from other. This view of self, this view from the ego, is this walling off and separating yourself from the immediate and actual experience of this moment. And it is delusion, and it is what causes us a lot of pain, a lot of difficulty. So this is what he's calling our attention to here. He makes an interesting point, too, in the last paragraph of that section. He says, when you love someone, what can you say about it? You say something and you never know. You say something, and in a sense, you kind of wall yourself away and apart. He says, even though you say nothing, both of you understand pretty well. If you always have to explain how much you love someone, you know, give some verbal idea here now. If you always have to explain how much you love some, it will create a lot of creaking noises between you. Because there is this separation, you know, and so now there's this, you're not moving together in the same flow of life here. You're now separated, and there's these creaking noises between you, because there's this separation. There is an in-between. And so now there's separation. He said, if neither party understands what is unexplainable regarding the other, life will not go smoothly. So this is a very interesting point that he makes. You might want to ponder that. The creaking noises comes when, you know, from our ordinary view, when we, which is basically to divide the world up, to divide ourselves off from other. And so we live in this kind of a fragmented view of our experience and our reality. It creates a lot of creaking noises. Yeah, I'll skip this next section. We talked about that last week. Well, now moving on to the face of emptiness. This is interesting, too. When we get into a discussion of egolessness, this word emptiness comes up. We talked about it last week briefly, and there's probably more I should say about this, because emptiness can be a little confusing. We'll get into that in a moment here. He starts out with, to receive a generous mind, to receive with a generous mind is to receive with no sense that things are either defiled or immaculate. It is to accept happiness within sickness, wealth within poverty, etc. To realize that sickness is within happiness, wealth within poverty, ugliness within beauty. To receive with a generous mind is to have no sense of ego, of self. To receive with a generous mind. If there is some sense of ego, even a small sense of ego, there is some separation between you and your situation. This is where the problem begins. You will hate, if you're sick, you will hate your sickness and you will complain about it. So you separate yourself as if there's you and then there's something else called the sickness. And now you've got this thing going here and you don't like it, of course. But now you create all kinds of trouble and difficulty. He says, further down, he says, because we don't really know how to satisfy or protect this self, we suffer because we don't know how. Of course, we don't want to suffer. We don't want to. Who wants to be sick? You know, I don't want to be, miserable with a cold or sore throat or cancer or whatever else. We don't want that, of course. Quite natural, but when you see yourself as apart from this situation and how this situation is confronting you, very difficult. He says, we don't really know how to satisfy or protect this self. And because of this, we suffer. A little further down, we suffer because we always try to handle our immediate problem as though it were apart from us, as though it were out there. To the awakened, to the enlightened, they don't see it in this way. They never see it in this way. They do not see their situation as out there, or their problem as being out there. There isn't any problem out there. There isn't anything out there that's annoying you or making you unhappy. And he gives this beautiful example here of the fellow who wants to start a business and he doesn't have any money, you know. I want to start a business. Well, as close to the Zen Master, Zen Master, well, then start a business. I don't have any money. Actually, we edited this down quite a bit. Gregory went on quite a while with this guy wanting, but I want money. I don't have money. Well, then you can't start a business. But I want to start a business. Well, then, you know. And he went on and on. Gregory probably went on for a whole page with that. But anyway, we cut it down. But finally, he gets to the punchline here with the Zen Master. He says, well, he said, I can't take away your suffering. But who creates this suffering? And this is the part that we always ignore. We see the problem is out there. I want to start a business, but I don't have any money. And then we get ourselves all worked up and sad and depressed or whatever. But who's creating this situation? If you want to start a business and you need money, well, if you really want to do that, well, then why don't you just find a way to do that? Well, what is he asking? You know, what is he asking of the teacher here? The teacher just directs the attention back to yourself. Take a look at your own mind and see what is going on within your own mind. If we are going to take care of our suffering, Kategori Roshi says, we have to know the true face of reality. We need wisdom, he said. Further down, the true nature of existence is constant change. We need to see the true nature of existence. It is constant change. This means that all things are empty of an abiding self. And then he says, in Zen we speak of 2 degrees of emptiness. I want to say a little bit about this term emptiness, because it can be very confusing, particularly when we hear it maybe for the first time. Emptiness, sometimes people confuse this with a kind of nothingness. It sounds maybe kind of bleak or sad or lonely or something like this. That is not emptiness. Emptiness, if we really understand emptiness, we understand full, complete freedom of mind. Emptiness is what? This is emptiness. Or this is emptiness, you know? Well, I don't mean our usual blockhead. But, you know, whatever you want to point to. Any thought or feeling is emptiness. Anything you can point to is emptiness. What does this mean, emptiness? Empty of what? Well, empty of being any particular thing at all. Empty of its own being, in other words. Everything is like this. We don't see it in this way. This is delusion. This is what is known as delusion in Buddhism. Delusion is that we're taken in by the illusion that there is some particular thing there, or thought or feeling. And but we never seem to notice that. If you look very carefully, you can never quite pin down just what anything is. Everything is in constant flux and change and motion and movement. Nothing really settles down. Nothing really shows you where it came from, where it's going, any kind of duration, because all there is this constant change. And so this means emptiness of any kind of selfhood, and emptiness of some kind of enduring quality. If we see that this is the true fabric and nature of our experience here, there is freedom in it. It is when we hold to this idea of a solid self that we suffer. He said this means that all things are empty of an abiding self. And then we speak of 2 degrees of emptiness in Zen, he said. The first is seeing directly that everything is impermanent. Okay, so we see this directly. That if you have something there, it is impermanent. You cannot put something there that is not impermanent. And the impermanence is total, it is thoroughgoing. Everything is impermanent, and that our lives are based in transiency. Our lives are based in transiency. Kind of a contradiction in terms almost, but because the base, there's no base, so to speak. It is just transiency. This is the reality and the fabric of our life. To try to cling to something is the bondage. We don't realize that. We think we need to cling to something to somehow, bolster us, sustain. This is that very reaching towards something. This is that dissatisfaction that we spoke of at the beginning tonight. To realize what is actually taking place here and to not feel the great need to grip anything here, we find this great freedom, freedom of mind. We need to realize that our lives are based in transiency. And by closely studying this, which is our actual experience, if you closely study our actual experience, not book learning or ideas or thoughts or whatever, but just to really learn to look at what our actual experience is, he says we can actually lose our sense of ego. And once again, this does not mean to marginalize the self, to dismiss the self, or anything of this sort. Nothing really changes. The experience is still the same in the sense. It's just that now we realize what it is. And that is the difference here. And with this, there is this loss of sense of self, this loss of the sense of something we need to protect, something that we need to aggrandize, something we need to please and promote, or something of this sort. There's a lot of effort and work going into a great deal of confusion there that all can drop away simply by learning to recognize what our actual experience is. Then the second degree of experiencing this emptiness here, the second degree is experiencing emptiness as the actual absence of our being. The actual absence of being. And this isn't like your being drops away or disappears or something like that. It's the realization that it, right now, There isn't any such thing as that. It's that we've been misunderstanding, misseeing what is really going on. This, of course, what he's speaking of here in this second degree of emptiness is enlightenment itself. The experience of emptiness as the actual absence of your own being. The true religious life must be free of any sense of self. And he gives us a wonderful example of the dancer. And it's not just the dancer. You could be a carpenter or a dishwasher or whatever you are in any given moment. If you really want to become what it is that you are doing, what you're experiencing, what is truly going on here, if you want to become with that, one with that, he gives us this example. He says, if you want to be a dancer, and if you forget this, I am dancing. You can't be a dancer. You can't truly be a dancer if you're thinking I am dancing, or look at how great my dancing is, or what a lousy dancer I am, or something like this. You just dance. There's just dancing. There's no you dancing, there's just dancing. If you want to be a dancer, just do what you need to do without being obsessed by fame or criticism, praise or blame, success or failure. This is to deeply understand emptiness. This is to deeply understand that there isn't any you there in the first place that is the dancer, that can be qualified as a good dancer, bad dancer, whatever. We can let this all drop away and just sink into the dancing itself. This is to deeply understand emptiness, so it is hardly a nothingness or a blankness or something disappointed. It is something really truly free and actually brings us into life and allows us to experience life fully. It is to experience the absence of your own being, he says. This is to really become a dancer. So this is how we become a dancer, experience the absence of your own being. He says on the next page, page 76, in experiencing the absence of our own being, we fully become we become fully alive. For we are not dependent on things. This is to be free from suffering. This is to be free from all suffering. If we just say, in the case of the dancing, then when the dancing stops, maybe not. But what he is really talking about is this state of mind, this realization. We can come into this state of mind in which we are truly the activity, the life of this moment, with no separation. We haven't walled ourselves or separated ourselves, projected our life out there like we're observing it as if we're watching a movie or something of this sort. We are actually the life. We are living it now. And this is to be free from suffering. This is also to be free from boredom. This is to acquire qualities of patience and wisdom and all kinds of other wonderful things are also occurring at the same time. This is why we must do zazen without expecting any kind of reward. And this is very important in meditation. When I teach the meditation class, we talk about this a little bit, that if we're going to take up this activity of meditation, if we take it up with the sense of, well, I am going to meditate because then I'm going to acquire these wonderful qualities or whatever, maybe I'll even become enlightened. When we think along these lines, we're just locked in our ordinary kind of thinking, and we don't recognize that we are just caught up in a greedy, grasping mind, basically a dissatisfied mind and a confused mind. There isn't any separation between you and the meditation. Of course, if we can learn to do this in our meditation, we can learn to bring this into other activities and other aspects of our life. So it says, this is why we must do zazen. Because, well, with zazen, with sitting meditation, we need to realize this right from the start, that this is what we are actually doing. Of course, we might not realize it, and then we are sitting because we're going to get something out of the sitting. After all, why wouldn't I do it? We're locked into that kind of thinking. But gradually, maybe we can come to realize we just sit in this meditation, or just sing the song, or dance the dance, or whatever it is you're doing, just do it completely for that activity and that activity alone. This is freedom of mind. This is the end of suffering and confusion. and we can learn to live out our entire life in this way. He said, this is most important. If you miss this point, your zazen will be just like everything else you do. So, in other words, what he's talking about now is in our ordinary way, we have always separated ourselves from the activity that we are doing, and I am doing this now, and oh, am I good at this, or am I not so good at this, or what are people thinking, or on and on and on with all this kind of stuff that comes with the separation. Here comes the worry, the pain, the suffering, the dissatisfaction, never really feeling like we're getting it, or whatever. On and on with all of this. Okay, this is why we must do zazen without expecting any reward. This is most important. If you miss this point, your zazen will be just like everything else you do. It will be the kind of meditation you find in pop psychology. So here we are. Where, what are we doing? This is what I was saying at the beginning, that you know, you get into some activity which is some kind of self-help activity or something. It sounds great, sounds wonderful, but how can you do that? How can you get that by separating yourself from what is really going on? I mean, if you're becoming preoccupied with yourself and trying to improve yourself, but at the same time you're separating yourself, and this is creating the misery and the longing and all the rest of it. He says, a little further down, sometimes we might talk about how wonderful zazen is, how it makes our life better. Yeah, we might talk about it like this. But he said, this is not zazen. If you talk about it in this way, the quality of your zazen, the quality of your mind, everything is going downhill now. We should take notice of this. He says, it is he now lays it out. This is what is going on here. If you just look at it, what's actually taking place in Zen and awakening is about recognizing what's really happening here. What's really happening? He says, this is dissatisfaction, longing, instability of mind. This is what we are practicing. This is what we've been cultivating all along with all of this, trying to improve ourselves and this and that, instead of just forget the self and step into the activity totally, completely. Burn yourself up in it in each moment. And whatever it is that you are otherwise trying to seek and find, you will have already. This is what he's pointing to here. So at the bottom he says, without asking for anything, expecting anything, or depending on anything, just do zazen. Your life will become really alive. Okay, well, didn't want to save some time for questions. On the other hand, I wanted to get, I don't know, any questions about that? I'll pause at the end of each section. Yes, Scott.
It seems so contradictory to me that up on the top part of the page he's saying if you look at zazen as a way to improve your mind or improve yourself, then that's not really zazen. And right. Then in the last sentence he's saying if you do zazen, then you will become really alive.
Yeah.
Can you explain the difference there?
Yeah. The difference is once again in our attitude and in our mind. If your mind is caught up and I'm trying to improve, you know, I'm trying to get this, but if you're thinking of it in these terms and you're seeing yourself as separate from the activity, you've blocked yourself now. And you will never acquire that thing that you seek. Whereas if you just let the self fall away, then you will find precisely everything that it is that you're looking for. But if you try to consciously go after that with some sense of self, you know, oh, I am doing this or that, or I am getting this or that from this activity or whatever, that there's the separation, and as a result of that, and it is just that. The thing you seek is over here, and you're here. But this is just something that's been projected in your mind. But as long as that's how you're thinking, it's going to stay that way. And so, how do we transcend that? You recognize what's going on here. Just recognize it, keep looking at it and looking at it, and at some point, boom, it'll drop away. And now you are the activity. And the result of that is, you know, your life will be really alive, as he said. You're fully alive. Of course, you're fully alive now, but we always kind of step outside of our life. You know, we live our life as though we're looking at it, as opposed to actually living it. You see? Do you see the difference here then? So really, in a sense, in one way, it all seems to be the same, but on the other hand, there's this subtle difference. It's subtle, but it's profound, and it's total. It's the difference between misery and confusion and not really having any real difficulty in life. just the ordinary everyday problems, which aren't problems. Okay, why don't we move on? Yes.
Yeah, I have a question that's been on my mind for a while. It's still more risky to ask it, but I'll try. I've been doing some study lately in basic Judaism, and one of the tenets there is that each of us is a piece of the divine, and which to me seems very compatible with what we're saying here. And but this one book was saying you have to become your full self. That if you don't, it's as though a piece of the divine has never been manifest. And so part of what life is about is becoming who you really are. Now, how do you fit that with no self?
Well, what
it seems to me, you know, for example, if you are a dancer, and that's what you are, then it's important to be a dancer and not to do something else.
Well, yes, but what's a dancer? That's the whole question. Can we ever identify what the dancer, who the dancer is? No, we cannot. There's just a dancing here. Does this need a body to dance? Yes, it does. Well, okay, well, what's that body? Who's the body? Well, we can't really say. The body is different in each moment. The mind is different. Everything is constant change. So what are we referring to here? You see, it doesn't get rid of the person, the body there. Well, maybe the person, but all the dance, all of that is still happening. It's alive in this moment. But there's no particular thing there. And to the extent that we see some kind of particular thing carrying this on, there's the separation, and there's the stepping out of the actual living of this moment. And but to manifest or to realize your true self, what is that exactly? Well, it isn't yourself as an ego. It is this very moment and what is taking place here, and you're not separate from it. Your life is being lived with all beings. In fact, your life is being lived as all beings, as all of reality being lived together here at once. Nothing is ever removed from it or separate from it. When we see in this way, that is our true self. He'll speak of this here by and by. In fact, we might get to it tonight. I don't know. But I don't know. Did that help you, Marjorie? Or?
But what if you, for example, were a professor of history right now instead of being a Zen teacher, and you felt this sense of dissatisfaction, like you weren't really doing what it is that is yours to do? I mean, isn't that something? Should we just say, "Oh, okay, well, I'll just be, in the moment"? Yeah, you could say that. But.
Well, yeah, right. I'm not talking about saying it. I hope I'm saying more than that. I'm trying to bring us to a point where we realize we have to not just talk about. Sink into this and do this. This is what the practice of meditation is all about: is to really realize what's taking place in this moment. But a professor of history or anything else, it doesn't really matter. To the extent that we see ourselves apart, there's the dissatisfaction. But if reality is that you aren't apart, no one ever is. If you were to see that, if you could see it in that way. Now what's your problem? You'll notice that those problems that you described are gone. They're only there because we create them in our mind. We project it as all. It's all the result of seeing our lives as separate. We see this fractured view of reality and of the world. And we're just one of the fractured parts. And as a result of that, there's the suffering. There's the confusion. You see, so what he's speaking of here is freedom from that. Freedom from that kind of view. Why don't we move on here, and the next section, knowing the world before you measure it, this might also help to, I think all these little sections we're going to be covering here will speak more and more to this. We can look at this in many different ways. He said, to practice deeply is to observe closely the emptiness of existence. But then he says, unfortunately, when we use the term observe, the idea of an observer comes up immediately. But this is just because we've used this term, observe. Any object you study, a little further down, any object you study is measured by your own yardstick. He used to say stick yard, but... I don't know if we ever got him to straighten that one out or not, but anyway. Any object you study is measured by your own yardstick. So any absolutes you observe are not really absolute. So anything that you think is really true and real, as long as it's something that you are thinking, something you are observing, it isn't actually ultimate truth or reality. To each thing you observe, you bring your own knowledge, your education, your past, your customs, your heredity. This is why we can all look at the same things and see them in different ways. And of course, it's all wonderful and good that we all have our own unique views, this is wonderful. But what about reality? What about the truth? What about what is actually taking place here? In the next paragraph, he says, "But to approach the spiritual life like this is very dangerous. The point of the spiritual life is to realize truth. Not your truth, or Buddha's truth, or Jehovah's truth, or someone else's truth, but truth itself, truth with a capital T, not some idea of truth, in other words, not some formed notion of truth, but reality itself immediately. This is the point of the spiritual life, is to wake up to the truth, no matter what we want to call that." He said, "But you will never understand the spiritual life or realize truth if you measure it by your own yardstick." So if you've locked yourself off in your own ego, separated yourself, and then now you're observing that out there and you're looking for the truth out there like that, you will not see it. You will always be picking up your manufactured version of reality or the truth. Get caught up then in picking and choosing and, you know, right and wrong and this sort of thing. This is what he talks about a little further down. He quotes Sen Sang here, great Zen patriarch in China, entrusting the heart and mind, which is one of the courses, by the way, that we teach here. We look at this piece. "The great way knows no difficulty." The great way, meaning the way of enlightenment, emancipation, freedom of mind, it knows no difficulties. And why do we seem to have so much difficulty? Well, it's because we're caught in our little mind. "The great way knows no difficulty except that it refuses to hold preferences," is the way he quotes it here. It just avoids picking and choosing, is another way of saying this. Why does it avoid picking and choosing? This way to awakening, this way of awakening itself, why does it avoid picking and choosing? Because it doesn't see this as opposed to that. It sees this and that all together in the whole fabric of reality. And this is the actual reality of our lives. When it is seen in this way, and we're not caught up now in this picking and choosing and this dissatisfaction. On page 78, second paragraph, midway, says, "When you see something moving, there's only movement. You cannot measure this total movement. All you can observe, all you can do is observe it directly and participate in it completely." So he says, you can't measure this total movement because it is the whole fabric that is moving. You can't hold it as an idea. In other words, you cannot conceptualize it. Actually, the idea of your participation, he says in the next paragraph, is highly questionable. Of course, this is the problem. It's a good thing. This is language keeps always language itself is so conceptual that it keeps locking us into these grasped notions and ideas. One of them, of course, is the notion of ourself. And so he catches himself here now, but it's just because of using language that we fall into these problems. We can't always catch ourselves, but he does it here. "Actually, the idea of your participation is highly questionable. If you ask, how can I participate in total movement? The total movement you speak of is merely something measured by your yardstick." In other words, it's just some idea that you have. And how can I participate in this total movement? Well, as long as you keep holding on to this notion of I, you cannot, because you're separate from it. But actually, in reality, in spite of that, you actually are. This is why we can wake up, because in fact we actually cannot step outside of reality, but it's just a matter of us learning to see what is really taking place. So, but if you're preoccupied with this notion about I, well, how can I participate in reality in this way, in this total movement of reality? Well, as long as you keep seeing it in that way, you're going to see yourself as separate. You cannot step into it and still retain your sense of you, as of a sense of self. But if that were to drop away, you would realize that all along you have been fully participating in this total movement of reality. He said that this doesn't mean that we should wipe away our preferences in order to know the great way. You will never succeed in doing that. It simply means to know the world as it is before you measure it, before you try to get a grip on it or hold it in some idea. And then he gives this beautiful example, I think, of looking for peace and harmony. And you know, we want peace and harmony. So he gives this example. He said, real peace and harmony are very simple. We might go out there marching for peace, but actually peace and harmony is very simple. He said, wherever you go, you can immediately practice them, because real peace and harmony are already in the world. Before you attempt to measure them, they are there. But you see, we might not notice that the world, this peace and harmony is right here. We can practice it immediately. But if we take some idea, well, I got to practice in a peaceful way. I got to practice peace and harmony, and then we form a marching, parade here, and we go down the street and try to encourage everybody to join us in our peaceful ways. It's not peace. We might have every intention, you know, to alert everybody to this real deep need to practice peace and harmony. But if we carry on in that way and carry it on as an idea, and wouldn't this be great if we could all just do this? Of course, it would be great if we could all, but how are we going to get people, how is it that we're going to actually practice this in this way? It is for each one of us to realize within our own heart and mind that peace and harmony is right here. If you have it, Thich Nhat Hanh speaks of this as being peace. If you want peace, just be peace. It isn't something you acquire or something you fight for or something of this sort. You just learn to find that right here within your own heart and mind. And in this way, maybe others can learn. It's not something we can force down the minds of others. Next page, he says, we take hold of something that has a particular form, saying, yes, this is it, this is truth. This is, you know, we have made truth into merely an idea. And we do this all the time. Further down, our problem is that we believe our relative truths are absolute. The way that we've packaged it in our mind, the way we've explained it to ourselves in our mind, we believe that this is true. This is reality. Reality is not something like that. And the Buddhas, the awakened ones, the awakened people, enlightened people, they do not speak in this way. They do not tell you what the truth is as though the truth were an idea or some belief or thought or opinion you can hold. It is not something like that. Truth is something that is actually, we're immersed in it. It's just a matter of waking up to it and seeing it directly, and that there's really nothing much we can say about it. Whatever it is that we do take a grip on and say, this is it, this is how, you can bet that someone else will grab another piece of it. And he says that this is why we're always fighting. Our problem is that we believe our relative truths are absolute. This is why we're always fighting each other. Because we all grab a different piece and don't realize what it is that we've done. Now, on the next page, he has this wonderful example of this mountain named Egolessness. Remember that one? He said on this mountain there's this wonderful tree named Great Enlightenment. And if you eat the fruit of this tree, you can experience, he says, great spiritual excitement. He means enlightenment here. He says, unfortunately, people don't know where this tree is. So they just start looking for it. They start eating the fruit of various trees. And one guy has this wonderful experience, but he says that his so-called enlightenment is just plain selfishness. Oh, I hate this. Oh, this is just great. But this is just just your ego. This is just ordinary talk, ordinary kind of thinking. He said, all of us are interested in looking for the enlightenment tree. Our problem is that we don't look for it on the mountain of egolessness. We don't realize it. This awakening that we look for, it cannot be for yourself. Done by yourself, apart from others. He says, generally we approach our practice with our eyes on just our own awakening. You should recognize the awakened have always pointed out to us that this simply doesn't work. This is to misunderstand practice, he said. And he's not just talking. Take this to heart. Realize what he's saying here. That this is just the way reality works. And to the extent that we remain caught. Now, how do you deal with this? Well, just start to notice your grasping mind here. And don't scold yourself because you've got a grasping mind. Don't get frustrated because it seems like you can't part from this grasping mind. Just keep looking at it. And eventually, that grasping need will weaken and drop away. But he says, generally we approach our practice with our eyes set on our own awakening. But this is to misunderstand practice. There is no self-awakening unless it is supported by other awakening. The idea of awakening by oneself doesn't make sense. Cannot be done. There isn't any oneself here to awaken. He said, if you emphasize yourself, self-awakening doesn't happen. True practice can't take place without others. Instead of searching and scavenging for enlightenment, you need to ask yourself what truth you seek. You need to just stand back and look at what you are doing. And if you see yourself with this grasping attitude, realize that you do not get to enlightenment with that. You do not get to Buddhahood with that kind of a mind. It is not that kind of mind. Recognize that. The mind isn't something that you pick up and drop off and things like that. It's realize what's going on, and that's the mind. That's the mind that you have. So it is a matter of just learning to catch yourself, to realize what you're doing in each moment. And that's awakening itself. Next section here, to realize a Buddha's life. So the highest level of human life is not to be found within our common sense understanding of things. Still, we cannot ignore or escape these views. And this is very important. While we do not find the highest level of human life within our common sense understandings of things, at the same time, we cannot dismiss these things. It's like with an ordinary truth, or your truth, my truth, or this, you know, Buddhist truth, or whatever you want to put there. With these ordinary kind of truths, these relative truths, we fall into, well, this is right then, and this is wrong. But with actual truth and reality, it doesn't have some opponent. It doesn't have some other. There isn't anything that counters it. So with the mind of awakening, it doesn't involve itself in the rejection of views, of any views whatsoever. We cannot ignore or escape these views. But we need to take care of them. We need to understand them. It isn't that we embrace them as though they were truth. No view is truth, including whatever personal and favorite views you have right now, and that includes me. We should be very careful of these things, respectful of the views of ourselves and others at all times, but realizing that at no time are any of these views, these personal views or cultural views or anything else you want to put there, are ever reality. They are not. But we can't ignore them because they are always there, and we have to deal with them all very respectfully. But the highest level of human life is not to be found there. It is not found within the common understanding of things. We have to understand our common sense views thoroughly, and then we must go beyond them. If you just stay with your usual understanding of things, just putting things together in your usual way, you've made your explanation to yourself, and so now that makes sense. He said, you will be like the frog that only swims in his small pond. Yeah, in the next page he says, I think we can all understand that image, I guess. In order to understand our territory, we have to, our small pond, in other words, I'm reading halfway down page 82 now, we have to go beyond it. We have to go to the place where we can see the overall picture of human life. We have to go outside our own view, in other words. We can only do this, he says, by throwing away, and that's what he's saying here. It's really not, you can't throw this away, it's more dropping off. Kadigiri knows this, he speaks of that in other ways. This is Dogen, the dropping off of our egoistic sense of things. Pretty hard to actually throw it away. But by observing it, looking at it, it will drop away of its own. But then he does quote Dogen here. I paraphrase this. He says, as Dogen put it, depending on our common sense view and egoistic notions while seeking the highest... depending on our common sense views and egoistic notions while seeking the highest level of human life is like driving our cart northward when we wish to go south. So we should really realize this and take notice of this gripping, grasping mind that we have. And not just in the meditation practice or Zen practice, but in every aspect of our life. By the way, he's always putting these in terms of Zen practice. Maybe for some of you this isn't too meaningful, but Zen practice, Katagiri also spoke of it in this way. This is just human life, everyday life. So you can substitute whatever you want there, your daily activity, when he's speaking here of practice. Because that is what you are practicing, and you could be practicing it mindlessly, or you can be practicing it with a very careful and deliberate mind. Maybe not so much a controlling mind, but a watchful mind and an attentive mind. And this is how we will eventually find awakening. He said, to seek the highest level of human life is very difficult. He said, for many people, it seems too hard. Well, I want to point this out, that while it might seem pretty hard, it's not as hard as the alternative. The ordinary life that we live is actually a very difficult life. And if we were to make this effort to wake up, to come into each moment and to be present and alive in each moment, that might seem hard, but actually... if we can begin to learn to work in this way, it is much easier than living in our ordinary way, though with our grasping mind. So the fact is, we are always just present in totality. Being here is not theory, but fact. To realize this fact is to have no sense of ego. To realize it, what he's speaking of here, is not to realize it as an idea, or a belief, or a thought, but to realize it by living it completely, wholly, with no sense of separation between yourself and what is taking place here. Well, once again, I didn't quite get to where I was hoping, but that's okay. We got about 4 minutes. I probably should stop. Yes?
I have a question on page 80 at the very bottom. It says, this is why we emphasize helping others first. I don't really understand this whole little area here. I mean, I know what it means for me, but what do you think?
Okay, this is a... Okay. Oh, to awaken others, to awaken oneself simultaneously. This is why we emphasize helping others first. Yeah, well, he's basically just saying just to forget the self. I wouldn't even put it so much, and he does say it elsewhere here, to not emphasize others first in the sense of oh, I will do this for them, but basically just he's speaking of the whole context here, and to put your mind in this place rather than focusing on the self. To the extent that we... another point he said, in fact, I think it is in... it was while I was editing this, but I believe it's in the book, where he talks about, say, if you wanted to be an artist, you know, and then he said, well, there's two ways of going about doing this, and one is where you emphasize yourself, where I'm going to be the greatest artist, you know, in the world or whatever, the greatest artist I can be, and the emphasis is on the self. He said that's one way, and I don't know how far is your art going to get with that, you know, but... The other way is to forget yourself and devote your life to art. So it's like devoting your life to the other, in other words. So it's like that, putting that other first. And in doing that, then that is the dropping away of the ego, forgetting. And what's going on here is like, well, this is why it isn't marginalizing yourself or anything of that sort. You're still here, you're still living your life. You know, the sun is shining, rising every morning, and you're eating breakfast, and life goes on. But if you can actually immerse yourself in this other way of looking at things, everything is going to taste far more, like he said, this is what really makes your life alive. And there's real freedom in that. But it's just, there's a subtlety to it. It's very subtle. And what exactly is it that we should understand? Well, there is. It isn't a particular idea that we need to grasp here, or something we need to believe in. It's something we need to learn to practice. And what is that? To observe our own minds and how it is that we are taking up each moment, what it is that we're trying to do. Are we breaking ourselves off from this moment, this activity, you know, in some way? Or are we allowing our lives to merge with what is really taking place here? One is bondage, one is freedom. And with that freedom, ultimately comes a complete, full understanding of what is really going on here. Within the bondage, we're always confused. We always, in the end of it, we kind of scratch our heads and we don't really know what's going on. Yes?
It almost seems like the sense of this is that you don't have to take stock ever of
how you're doing?
No, ever.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, but somebody once asked him, how many people have you helped? Okay, this is after he'd been in this country 25, 30 years or so. Yeah, well, not 30. He didn't live that long. But he'd been here quite a while. And how many people have you helped? And he said, I've told this story, but some of you know this, I think. Remember what he said? He said, it's none of my business. It's none of my business. What is his business? What is the business for each one of us? You know, it's like, how many people have you helped? Well, how about living your life thoroughly, completely in each moment? And then you're helping people, but are you keeping a scorecard? You know, you know, that doesn't work, you know. And, well, okay, you can keep a scorecard and maybe you have helped two or three along the way, you know. But if you just drop the scorecard, maybe, you know, you can help many more. But it's like that. And so, yes, you don't need to keep some kind of reckoning of, you know, your progress and how you're doing and all of that. And this is why I say, too, like in the meditation instruction that I offer, don't judge yourself. Don't judge your meditation. You can learn to not judge yourself in your own progress. You can begin to learn to not judge others as well. Or the situation. That doesn't really help us a whole lot. What is more important that we actually learn to see what is taking place in this moment, what is going on within our own mind, and to just step into that. We're not crazy or stupid. We'll deal with it if we can see it. But when we're caught up in our own imaginings and that, and we're dealing with that, but we're not really dealing with reality. And this leads to all kinds of difficulty and trouble. Not to mention it leaves us feeling kind of lonely and sad and cut off and isolated from other, and it's not particularly happy. Well, we have gone over, so we'll pick this up again next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.